Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
You're listening to The Sound of London. This is Londonist Out Loud. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and this episode hinges on a particular term that I kept hearing every time we talked about the story of London and its history, and I decided that it was about time we put some flesh on the bones of that term. So this week on the show, we're going to be investigating the rookeries of London.
Hey baby, let me take you down, so we'll play some strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the light before, just a stone's throw from your front.
Well, hello, hello, listener. If I raise my voice just enough, we can get a bit of an echo going on here from the barrel-vaulted ceilings of the crypt in which you find us. If this introduction seems slightly disjointed, it's because I'm trying to put from my mind the fact that about 2 metres behind me is a pile of coffins, and I mean a pile of full coffins. If I turn around here, I'm going to turn away from Sarah Wise just for a second. Behind me is the open door to the vault of Mr. John Allport, 1807, and a pile of coffins, one of which may indeed contain Mr. John Allport. And depending on how things go, he may appear as a surprise guest. For now, Sarah Wise.
Hello.
How's that for an introduction?
Excellent.
One point to you for not being dead.
Not yet.
This is eerie. To our left, we've got a very realistic Jesus on the cross. Realistic in the sense of it being life-size and he being emaciated and crucified. There's a golden crucifix on an altar, and the whole place is in a state of glorious disrepair. We're in the vaults of St. Leonard's in Shoreditch. Sarah Wise, why have you brought us here?
Well, it's one of the few surviving buildings that were around at the time of the old Nickel Slum, about which I'm, rather sadly, a bit of an expert. I trained as a journalist, and I guess I'm always after a scoop, even if that scoop's 200, 150, 100 years old. I'm always trying to find the stories that haven't yet been told, which are hidden away in the archives. And the really good news is that our British archives, whether they're local or nationally held, are absolutely jam-packed with documentation, just crying out for people to get in there and start leafing through, because all these people who, you know, they have left traces of themselves. And I just think it's intellectually and emotionally really satisfying to try and tell stories that haven't been told from before, from people who maybe haven't sort of been heard since they died.
What sort of journalism did you do? Do you do?
Well, I was a magazine and newspaper production person. So that's the sub-editor. That's the person who takes all the jokes out, folks. And proofreader. Just getting things onto the page. And then I sort of left. When I left that, I did a bit of features writing. Quite a lot of arts and architecture writing. Mainly for The Guardian. And then I went back to school. I did a part-time master's at Birkbeck College, University of London. I only did it for fun, I did it for pleasure, but it completely changed my life. And the subject of my first two books occurred as a result of doing an essay on that course. In 1995, just a few yards from here, we took a wrong turning off Bethnal Green Road and drove into this glorious new estate, the Boundary Estate, and it instantly set me thinking about the whole area, and eventually it led to my first two books. So a series of really happy accidents is how my work came about.
And a great testament to Birkbeck, by the sounds of it.
Yes, I think so. Mind you, I keep getting begging letters from them now that it's all gone privatised, but one didn't make much money out of one's books, so I can't, I can't contribute.
I should say, by the way, you're going to be hearing crunching and grinding noises and footsteps dragging across the concrete in the background. This is not Mr. John Allport. Well, now, Sarah Wise looks disappointed.
Yeah, I am. It's a couple of really nice removals chaps, because the Vicar of St. Leonard's has stuffed his crypt, not just full of bodies, but full of some absolutely glorious old furniture that is currently being shifted about. So it's not the dead walk-in, it's removal chaps.
This reminds me a little bit of those farming auctions where they'll parade the beast before you. And we've got a lovely two-door dresser coming past here. Looks like it might be walnut, perhaps. Some nice inlaid details there. Well, we'll keep the updates coming as to what's available for you, listener. I wanted to talk to you in particular because this word rookery that crops up, particularly in connection, I guess, with Dickensian themes, rookeries often get a mention. But I realise that we've never really said too much about them. I think we know that they're places where poor people lived all on top of each other. That's about it, though. And I wanted to get you on and find out what you've learned about them and perhaps what we might not know about them.
Well, across the whole of the last, the 19th century, dotted throughout London, not just the East End, it's important to say, there were lots and lots of areas that we know as slums, also known as rookeries, where old, decaying houses have been sort of colonised by people who simply couldn't afford to live anywhere else. So classically, and the one I wrote about here is the old Nickel, but you also had the Mint area down in Southwark back then. You had St Giles, just off what is now New Oxford Street. That was a particularly bad one. Further out west, you had Notting Dale, also known as the Piggeries, so that's sort of quite far out. So dotted all over London, you had these terrible areas, and fiction writers such as Dickens painted amazing pictures of it. So in Oliver Twist alone, you've got Jacob's Island in Bermondsey, you've got really unpleasant parts of Bethnal Green, you've got Saffron Hill come Field Lane. But it's interesting that not until the end of the 19th century do you get that real emergence of an east-west polarity. If you look at any of the fiction and the non-fiction throughout the 19th century, till about the 1870s, you've got these slums east, south, northwest of London. And then gradually they start to get erased by a variety of so-called metropolitan improvements, which tended to be the driving through of huge, great new roads, which were always sited on top of rotten, cheap old property, because obviously that's the cheapest to buy up. So obviously you've got things like Shaftesbury Avenue, Charing Cross Road, New Oxford Street, Commercial Street, Commercial Road. All these, Victoria Street went through the Devil's Acre slum just behind Westminster Abbey. So across the century, from about the late 1830s, you get the piecemeal eradication of lots of very intense congested slum areas. That's less the case in the East. And so, as I say, as the century starts to end, the East End starts to become synonymous with huge tracts of really poor quality housing, which of course is the only the housing that the poor and the pauperised could afford.
There's a lot to unpack in all of that. Goodness me, where to start? Oh, the one that jumped out at me first was the idea of somewhere called Notting Dale, which seems like a companion to Notting Hill.
That's right. It was, Notting Hill is right on top of the big hill that Ladbroke Grove goes over. Go down the other end, and you're in Notting Dale. And today, it's all where sort of Latimer Road is, I think Treadgold Street. And even when I went to school in Wood Lane, and even then, in the sort of late 70s, early 80s, still sort of an area of quite a lot of comparative deprivation, really.
Well, Ladbroke Grove didn't used to be the flash place it is now.
Absolutely not. I mean,
people in, I guess, middle age would remember paying peppercorn rents in Ladbroke Grove still.
Definitely. No, absolutely. Well, even when I sort of moved there when I first left home, and it was still totally affordable. But that's true of so much of West London. It's kind of been transformed out of all recognition. All the sort of totally affordable, slightly down-home parts of West London are just, you know, going for multi-million pounds.
Well, OK, so that actually begs a different question than the one I was going to ask, I suppose, and we'll maybe expand on some of those places, particularly the Devil's Acre. We need to know more about that place. With your eye on the tides of how affordability has worked, I don't know whether it's fair to bring in the word gentrification. It sounds like a different sort of process, maybe improvement, maybe just complete destruction and reinvention from what you're saying. Do you think that there is a chance that for example, the East and West could flip? Is it possible that an area which has always been known for being the cheap, poor bit of town, is there any chance it could reverse its fortunes?
Well, where we're sitting now, Shoreditch, Bethnal Green, is completely unaffordable. I mean, the Boundary Street estate opened in 1900, replacing in its entirety, acre for acre, the old Nichols slum, and it was London's first sizeable council estate. It's not true to say it's the first council housing. There were a little bit of piecemeal attempts done earlier, but it's London's first significant council estate. In the late 90s, gradually started, some of it was started to be sold off onto the open market, and so now a studio flat on Boundary Street itself going for about £500,000, £750,000 pounds, which is completely not in the spirit of which, you know, the London County Council put up this fantastic new estate. After Brexit, who knows what's going to happen property-wise? I mean, everything's gone up in the air as of the 23rd of June. So, I don't know, perhaps it might all become affordable again.
Well, I was reading something today, and the idea was that people don't really pay too much attention to geopolitical stuff when buying their house. They just, you know, have I got a deposit? Yes. Have I found the house I want? Yes. Off we go.
Yeah. On the other hand, if it's true that mega corporations are just going to pull their staff en masse from London and situate them in continental cities, then that could just be the sort of like first unravelling of the whole thread. Really wouldn't like to predict. I think we're into really kind of futurology is particularly dangerous at this time.
We're very conscious of various funds and investment vehicles buying up property around London. Was there anything like that going on in the period when these rookeries existed?
There sort of was. One of the things I discovered when researching the old Nichols slum, and it holds true for us all these slums that I mentioned across London, one of the ways in which the estates of deceased people kept on and on making money, one of the best investments you could possibly make was in slum property. Because the inspection and improvement of these terrible, I mean lethal, lodgings was so lax, a landlord would need to make very few repairs until sort of forced through the courts, which very rarely happened. And the amount that you could make just by packing, say a house down in Old Nichols Street, for example, had 10 rooms that were home to 90 people. You pack people in, you make absolutely no repairs, one late 19th century evening newspaper suggested that profits of 150% per annum were being made by landlords. There was this kind of attenuated chain of property ownership. So often lords and ladies at the Church of England, I'm ashamed to say, here sitting here in the basement of St. Leonard's, all sorts of people who should have known better were making an absolute fortune out of being slumlords. But they managed to disguise themselves because they would hand over the running of their leases down to agents. And so whenever people tried to find out who is responsible for this dreadful house where the ceiling has fallen in and killed two children, it was very hard to find out who was actually the real owner. If you were lucky, and several journalists got onto this, particularly from the Daily Telegraph, funnily enough, trying to find out who is responsible for this lethal property, they might get as far as the agent, but they'd have to dig very, very hard to find out, for example, whether it was Lady this or Lord that. One of the very worst examples, utterly notorious, was the Duke Duke of Northampton and his holdings up in Clerkenwell, replaced in its entirety by that lovely Peabody estate that's there now. There's a lot of money to be made, but as the century came to an end, you had this cacophony of people who weren't going to take this anymore. You had political radicals, you had many people from the churches investigating, you had really committed journalists, you had all sorts of philanthropists, all just starting to get together and saying, this housing situation is absolutely not good enough. We have got to change it. And when in 1889, London at long last gets its first unitary authority, the London County Council, they ask Londoners to suggest what areas are so bad that we need urgently to deal with them. And they had something like 150 different places named throughout London by members of the public, of which they selected 31 for serious urgent repair and or demolition, and 17 of those 31 were actually in the East End. And the most important one, as I've said, turned out to be the Old Nickel, hence the Boundary Street estate.
It'd be interesting to develop that idea of what life was like in one of those estates. But I wonder, just on the macro picture there, and we've reflected this in previous episodes, that there was this big move in the late Victorian period towards general improvement, improving the lot, particularly of poorer people. You're the person to ask, why? Why did it suddenly become the case that people were interested in looking after the poorer in society?
Well, there's more than one answer to that. On the one hand, you did have, from, let's say, 1880, a massive resurgence in left-wing politics, better organised than it had previously been since, let's say, 1848 and the collapse of Chartism. The left, as ever, always in disarray, always arguing with each other, but you did actually get them for once starting to sing from a similar song sheet. And when the London County Council came into being in 1889, its first elections were overwhelmingly in a landslide for what was loosely termed the Progressive Party. So that's the radical wing of the Liberals, influenced by socialism, of which Marxism is only one small form. Other types of socialism are and were available. Again, you have this marvellous exposés being done by a huge range of very committed journalists. I think novelists too really played their part in bringing home the awfulness. Arthur Morrison's Child of the Jago is possibly the most powerful novel in the slum genre, all of whom, I think, can trace their inspiration back to the publication, again, from 1889, key date, Charles Booth's Poverty Map, and his accompanying 17 volumes, Life and Labour of the People in London. So you get this extraordinarily well-written, thoroughly researched, colourful and yet not emotional, I don't mean that, but sympathetic view of life on the ground, how the very worst excesses of capitalism play out in ordinary people's lives. So that's the unemployed, the chronically ill, the elderly, and perhaps most distressing of all, children.
Yeah. But these political shifts and the literature that you're talking about, these, tell me if I'm wrong, these must have been appealing to the educated upper classes, because I might be completely wrong about this. We know that women didn't get the vote until the early 20th century, but I'm reasonably certain that there was a large portion of the impoverished part of society in general that didn't have the franchise.
That's absolutely right. The middle and lower middle classes obviously were able to lead the charge because they had access to power, access to having their voice heard. So you had an increasingly sympathetic tier of middle, upper and lower middle class people fighting these campaigns. But one of the things I think that was so cheering, and one of the reasons that I think, let's say 1914, the outbreak of World War One, you do have a really rather different Britain than you have in 1880, is a series of bridges that were able to be built between well-disposed upper and middle-class people and working men and women. So what you get is the increasing democratisation of such things as the welfare administration. Thanks to a number of campaigners, you start to get working men and women coming forward. Obviously, they haven't got a lot of spare time because they have to work, but coming forward in such things as how workhouses are run, for example, how relief welfare payments that are given in your own home, how those are spent. So it isn't one class sort of deciding, making these decisions for another class. You start to get them harmonising. You see that particularly in education. Women starting to be elected from a very early years onto the London school boards. You see a huge unrolling of programmes of free medical inspection and help for school children. Where we're sitting, actually, one of the most innovative schemes, Lady Jeune, as she was known, a West End philanthropist. She starts out just around the corner in the Old Nickel School. She, with her own money, she starts giving free breakfasts and lunch to children who are literally starving. And she starts giving them clothing. And women like her start off as charity workers. And then many of them, they cross over about 15 years into what is starting to be called social science. And so they stop doing it from a point of view of charity, and they start to make it into a statutory duty, particularly with regard to children, particularly with regard to women. And so you start to see certain sections of the very poor slowly being lifted out and being given, well, for want of a better word, state assistance that they are now entitled to. So in 1906, you get old age pensions coming in, which is a massive help. That helps to take a huge section of the poor out of poverty, or at least alleviate it. I've mentioned free school dinners. That really, really did help children. And you start to see the better classification and access to free care of the chronically ill or the chronically disabled. So it really was a kind of really happy combination of the well-intentioned wealthy, the increasingly literate and educated and curious working and lower middle class. And I do have to say, when the big changes came with Lloyd George's 1906 People's Budget, where you really start to see the foundations of what we recognise as a welfare state being put in place, one of the reasons he's able to push this through is because people were able to argue now, using statistics, using investigation, that the countries that are taking care of their population are actually starting to outperform Britain. Namely Germany. If you have a workforce, let's just limit it to working men who are ill, in a terrible physical shape, their housing is awful, they're underfed, they're getting every disease that's going, you can't keep your factories running efficiently, and you certainly can't get a decent army together. They had a real shock during the Boer Wars when they tried to recruit working men. The amount of working class men they had to turn away because their health was absolutely shattered because of the appalling poverty they were enduring. You look across to Germany, that's really starting to get itself together in terms of housing, in terms of access to healthcare. And so I'm afraid a lot of the good changes that came about was simply because they wanted a better functioning industrial war machine, which isn't very charitable at all.
No, and up until that point, I was very excited by what you said. I was thinking about Freud, and I was contemplating the undoing of that sense of it being cool to be kind, and what seems to me to be a deterioration into consumerism and feeding the self and all of that stuff that has been the hallmark of the late 20th century, I guess. And it just sounded like, you know, we've had this amazing blooming of technological advance in the 20th and into the 21st century, and it just sounded like socially that must have been a comparably very exciting time to be around.
Absolutely right. And the other thing I could have mentioned is that things did generally get better financially, because, as I've mentioned, from 1870 you have the education of the working classes. And so what you get in a huge rise in, certainly in London, how it plays out in non-urban areas I'm not quite so sure, you get a rise in better jobs, which obviously pay more. So that's another way in which people are starting to be lifted out of poverty. I mean, classically, in the mid-1880s, you're a teenage girl, maybe you're 14. What are the best options open to you? They're standing behind a bar for 15 hours a day, earning absolutely nothing, on your feet and in terrible.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Circumstances, or if you're lucky, in one of the better quality shops. 20 years later, if you've done pretty well at board school, you can start to get into the sort of pink collar ghetto that's emerging. So typists, stenographers, lady clerks, teaching. So you are starting to get lower middle class jobs expanding. And taking in a lot of people whose parents would have been perhaps street traders. You're starting to get sit-down desk jobs which pay better.
I'm suddenly thrilled with fear, because some of the stuff you're describing there, it sounds to me as though we are regressing towards, if anything. If we think about the rise in multiple occupancy, the inability of people to afford places that are any good, the gradual denationalisation of the health service, things like that. I mean, there's no doubt we're a long way from rookeries, but it sounds as though we're heading towards rather than away from.
Not one to plug anything that Mr Murdoch does, but just earlier this week on Sky, there was a very, very good report, The New Slums, a camera crew and reporters going around certain parts of now suburban East London, and the absolutely appalling conditions that are coming back now. It's particularly horrific for me because, of course, you think you're writing a book about the past, about history, and blow me down. You can see all this stuff coming back again. My own personal politics, with which your listeners may not agree, is that if capitalism doesn't work for anyone but a small percentage, you cannot be surprised that certain phenomena return, back from the dead, come back to haunt us. And what upsets me most is that we've been here, we conquered it, we very slowly and not entirely satisfactorily got a lot of it sorted. We know what works, we know what doesn't work, so why are we sleepwalking back into, dreadful chronic injustice. It makes me angry, but anyway, I'll be not tub thump anymore.
Why not? No, I always think that who better than an historian actually to get some perspective on?
Well, right wing historians are available.
Yeah, we often get accused of being very, very left wing on the show. Let's come back to rookeries, though. We've travelled a long way from rookeries. The Devil's Acre sounds fascinating.
Yes. It was just a nickname, and I don't think really. I'm not sure that actually.
Well, what a nickname!
It's a great one, and it's slap bang up against Westminster Abbey, so even more resonant for that. Yes.
Well, just, no, hang on. How did this come about? Because if Galliard Homes was putting together a new development, they wouldn't call it the Devil's Acre.
Should do. I'd buy one if I could afford it. What can I say? Oh, well, actually, listeners, you may wish to find quite easily Gustave Doré, one of his fantastic illustrations. He went wandering around the Devil's Acre, and I think you'll easily find online his take on it. Just your classic rotting late 17th century houses that were probably fit for purpose once, but over the centuries have deteriorated. And obviously, if you're poor, that's all you can afford. Massive overcrowding, because, of course, the more you pack together, the cheaper your collective rent is. And so in the 1840s, it was one of the most notorious sites. There were many, but that was one of them. And the answer is, what do you do? How do you get rid of this? Two things. You build something new called Victoria Street. Victoria Street is one of London's... I love these streets. They're completely made up. They don't follow any particular natural line at all. So you bulldoze this brand new, very broad street, and it connects Victoria right through to the Houses of Parliament. And one of the happy side effects is that you, at a stroke, you demolish lots and lots of really rotten, cheap, nasty property. So problem solved, isn't it? You demolish a slum, no more slum. Of course, people very, very quickly spotted, well, actually, all you've done is you've made a couple of thousand people pack even tighter into the remaining stumps of horrific lanes and alleys. You haven't solved the problem at all. You've made it worse. The same thing happened all over London. They put these fantastic new streets in. Farringdon Road, at the same time, took out hundreds and hundreds of nasty little houses in Clerkenwell, but all you get is people sort of packing ever tighter around. Yeah,
I was sort of expecting that there would be some sort of solution reached, but no, that's it, that's the resting point.
Well, what you get in the 1840s is the start of the large-scale philanthropic housing companies. Now, these were charitable bodies, but their sort of nickname was the 5% philanthropists. So the wealthy people who subscribed to these companies from about 1844 did expect a return on their rental. So you get, I mean, down at Streatham Street near TUC House, you get one of the very, very first of these philanthropic blocks. They look quite cute to us today, but I think they were viewed by the poor as kind of barracks. And, of course, when you put a block like that up and it's run by stony-hearted philanthropists, there's all these rules and regulations. So lots of poor people naturally rule themselves out because they did want their children to be able to kick a ball around. They did want to be able to have their washing out. So you get the start in the 40s and 50s of philanthropic blocks, which did their best, but, of course, if you make, I don't know, 1,500 people homeless and you put up a block that houses 150 people, you've still got a massive load of people who have not been rehoused. And rehousing, the issue of rehousing, dogged redevelopment for about 30 years, really, until the LCC came along in 1889. Fantastic quote from was he a bishop? Whenever he's trundling along New Oxford Street, which opened in the late 1840s, and that was bulldozed right the way through the St Giles Rookery, he said, whenever I'm trundling along this street, I cannot help but think about the poor people who got turfed out, who once lived on this spot and aren't here now. What on earth have we done? So a lot of people thought, well, this metropolitan improvement malarkey, actually, it's not making any improvement for many people at all.
Should we talk about life? And maybe St Giles Rookery is a good one. I know you're writing about that at the moment. You mentioned 90 people, I think, in a 10-room place. What was life like in that room?
An awful lot of people kept themselves out of their room by street life. One of the things that shocked middle-class observers, including Charles Booth, was the amount of life that took place in poor districts out on the streets. If you had a revolting home like that, the last place you wanted to be was at your home, apart from when you were sleeping. And so working-class people was notable by being out and about. And the other thing that you did, which I think quite rightly horrified, including a local magistrate down at Worship Street Magistrates Court, men and women, actually, he piled into the pub. The gin palaces were brightly lit, they were warm, they were cosy, they were comparatively clean. You had lovely plate glass, you had gas jet chandeliers. And one of the horrors, particularly that the new LCC had, which did have a big anti-drink temperance wing among its administrators, was that if you have such revolting housing, you're driving people into the hands of the publicans. And many people started to make the connection between alcoholism or the working classes spending a hell of a lot of their income on drink. A local magistrate just down at Worship Street Magistrates Court, he made that connection. He completely got it. How lovely a pub would seem in comparison to your verminous home. So many of the first intake, the big progressive wing at the London County Council, they were also what was known as temperance campaigners, very seriously anti-drink. And so I think that gave urgency to their desire to create homes, social housing, so that people would want to stay at home, you know, because it's a nice place to be in comparison to the pub. And when the London County Council bought up the Old Nickel in its entirety, two things held them up for a very long time. The Church of England, would you believe it, held out for ages to get the highest compensation they could. I'm glad to say they didn't manage it, but they caused a lot of trouble to the LCC. And the other people who caused trouble were the various brewing companies who tried to extort really high amounts from the LCC in order to give up their licences, because the LCC was determined that the estate was going to be dry. There'd been, I think, 15 pubs in this very small area, and then immediately surrounding it, up to 100 other pubs. So the people at the LCC thought, well, we kind of want that to not be the case. So they spent an awful lot of money buying out pub licences, and the estate is today sort of dry, apart from the cafes and restaurants, etc., that are on Calvert Avenue. So the whole anti-drink thing kind of dovetailed with the whole, you know, urge to get decent social housing.
OK, that's interesting. That tells us something, I guess, about the different economic balance that we have now, because pubs are collapsing left, right and centre. People aren't going to the pub. Meanwhile, our housing cost is going up and up.
No, I hadn't actually thought of that. That's true. I suppose we're all drinking at home, aren't we? In our lovely, expensive little studio flats that we have to share with 17 other people.
We're huddled around a can of Tennent's and nine straws.
Yeah.
What would people in the Rookery be doing? Both, you know, if they're earning money, how are they earning it? And what's the line between somebody who's going to end up in a Rookery and someone who isn't?
Well, the Old Nickel is probably quite typical. And when I sort of delved into it, there were 5,700 people living here at the time that the LCC came and pulled it down, of whom 40% were under the age of 15. And I think that's a major change we would notice if we could go back in time. How young London was. I mean, it was packed with kids and teenagers. A slum like this also would have a disproportionate number of old people, because of who, of course, who are going to be poor? Children, old people. It also had more single female-headed households than were average across working class and lower middle class districts. Many of these women were struggling not just to bring up their children, but also other dependents, such as relatives who were chronically ill or disabled, maybe their aged parents as well. So astonishing women who are just keeping four or five people afloat in their little hovel, doing revolting jobs 16 hours a day for diminishing wages. Just astonishing tales of heroism. So many of the husbands, they were either widows, or perhaps their husband had deserted them, perhaps he was in prison. So you do see lots and lots of female-headed families, which were much less typical elsewhere. I often wonder now whether what a slum in general, I know the Old Nickel in particular, I think the process goes like this. Something goes wrong in your life, really badly wrong, and you can't afford to live anywhere else, so you move here or to another slum, which is the cheapest property you can possibly afford. I think about the cheapest you would pay is something like 2 shillings for a really nasty little basement running with damp. If you can't afford that, or your life goes even further wrong, your next choice is the common lodging house, of which there were two very large ones in the Old Nickel, and there were loads and loads in Whitechapel. So you can think of it like a hostel today, except hostels are sort of properly run and probably have some kind of charitable input. These were private enterprises, so that's your next step, where you're lucky if you get a bunk or a box or a mattress to sleep on, and it's charged by the night, classically tuppence a night. If you can't even manage that for whatever reason, your next choice is twofold. You've got the gutter, which was actually preferable in many Cockney's minds to the workhouse. The workhouse was where nobody wanted to end up, because of course what you were doing there was giving up all your independence. You're more or less shrugging your shoulders, that's it, I can't cope.
What was the trade? What were you doing? How does the workhouse function?
You go indoors, and it's not quite prison, but it's the next worst thing. If you simply cannot fend for yourself financially, you have a bed and you are fed three meals a day, but you're basically inside. You can't leave. People can visit, but you're more or less in, the nickname for them was the Bastille. And you gave up all independence. You had absolutely nothing of your own. And yes, in the old days, you would do a task of work while you were in there. But actually, in fact, in the 1880s and 1890s, if you went into the classic London workhouses, it's packed out with the aforementioned people. People who are chronically ill, disabled, elderly, thousands and thousands of children in there. One of the worst things that it did was it split up families. So if a husband and wife couldn't cope, they were segregated. So you give up your rented home. All your furniture would be sold in order to recoup any costs, so you had nothing. You didn't even have your family anymore. You do read tales in coroner's reports in the newspapers of people deciding to take their own life before that step. And people wonder, well, why would anybody be a tramp or a vagrant? Well, at least a tramp and a vagrant has their freedom, they have their mobility, and they do have their independence. And many people would rather have become a tramp or a street prostitute than give it all up and become a prisoner of the state just for being poor.
I suddenly understand this dimension to a lot of Victorian, it's usually fiction, but it's stuff that's purporting to portray lower end Victorian life realistically. And there's always this pride that's in the mix there somewhere, and suddenly that falls into focus.
For what it's worth, Charles Booth and other people kind of coming up with the same conclusion is what they thought about the London poor, what they wanted more than anything, if you can generalise, was to be their own boss, to be their own master in whatever little trade it was they'd undertaken. I mentioned all the categories of poverty in the Old Nickel, but in fact, most people, most adults, including women, were working very, very hard. One-fifth of people who lived here were employed in the furniture trade, bashing together all sorts of, cupboards and shelves and whatnots and this, that and the other, to sell down at the Curtain Road Shoreditch Emporia. So manufacture was huge here. Shoe, boots and textile manufacture were the next biggest employers. But what you also had in these sort of horrible little rooms was really high quality artisan work being done, particularly in the metalwork trades and all sorts of specialised woodwork. Women, if they got a lucky break, were particularly adept at French polishing furniture. And one of the men who grew up here, he said, every hooligan in the Nickel always wanted to get himself hitched to a French polishing woman, because then you'd never have to work yourself, because she earns so well. So this idea of it being full of sort of loafers and layabouts and thugs is not right. The other thing that was, there was still very picturesquely the remnants of the Huguenot weavers. So you had particularly elderly people turning out this amazing quality silks and satins and all sorts of fabrics that were the best quality in continental Europe. And apparently even the Pope and even the English royal family sourced some of their fabrics from Old Nickel weavers, because the quality was still outstanding. The problem there was that these specialised artisan work, there was lesser and lesser market for it, and you have great big emporia such as Maples and Heels in the West End parceling out their work to such garrets, but for lower and lower wages. So you had a real squeeze on wages of people who were extremely talented and hard-working, which obviously, you have the early attempts at unionisation in the 80s and 90s, always much less successful in London than elsewhere in the country. But that's one of the things that unions were trying to fight, to stop this endless depression of wages and the lengthening of hours. But as I say, I think most Cockneys, if you ask them, they didn't want to be employed particularly by anybody. They wanted to do their own thing, get a fair price for it. I think it's that love of independence amongst the working classes that kind of slightly baffled many left-leaning people who wanted them to join in unions. They didn't quite get, If you want to be your own boss, then does that mean you're not going to be quite so willing to join with other workers to campaign together? I mean, obviously that changed in the early 20th century and people did come on board with that whole idea. But London did prove quite hard to unionise outside of things like the Dockers, for example.
And we could maybe open up a conversation about the proliferation of self-employed and one or two person businesses that's going on at the moment. Is that symptom of something rather dark? I don't know. But we haven't got time to, so we won't be going down that road. And in fact, we're coming quite close to the end of things here. I'm delighted to say that Mr. John Allport remains in his original position. Well, not his original position, his final position. You've been down there, haven't you? When I say down there, I'm talking about this little archway with its inscription. It's only about 3.5 feet tall. Yeah. What's down there?
It's a collection of old lead coffins that kind of look rather disrespectfully all shoved in together. I don't think that's how it was.
Yeah, they're not on shelves or anything, are they?
Shelves, as in the Kensal or Highgate. It does look a bit of a jumble in there, but as I understand it, as I've had it explained to me, these are lead coffins of the wealthy, and they're all still in there, apparently. Yeah, listening to us.
Well, at least somebody is. we've got to come to a close. What are you working on at the moment? I know St. Giles features in it. What are you working on? Can you say?
Yeah, no, I've sort of turned my attention to Soho in the 19th century. Funnily enough, nothing like as easy to research as the East End. It had, well, St. Giles obviously was the great big slum, and there's quite a bit on that, but the other side of what is now Charing Cross Road, Soho proper, similar sort of argument going on. Very, very, very highly skilled manufacturing people, artisans, also known as the aristocracy of labour, struggling against mass importation of luxury goods, great big shops and warehouses forcing prices down. So I'm kind of shifted my interest over to the West. Everybody thinks, oh, there was this East-West dichotomy. But in fact, you found some dreadful pockets of political struggle over there in Soho. So that's kind of what I'm into at the moment. And then at some point, I must leave London. A terrible sort of, you know, London-centric history focus. I ought to start looking at other places.
I think on this podcast, we can put up with the London focus for the time being.
Yeah.
We'll tolerate it.
Yeah.
And a reminder of your website and your titles. What would you like the listener to rush out and purchase?
Well, have a look at my website, sarahwise.co.uk. And the book I wrote about the old nickel is called The Blackest Streets. The book I wrote about an area just north of the Nickel, today's Columbia Road, is the Italian Boy, a very nasty case of kind of Burke and Hare-style murdering to supply the surgeons. And then my latest one ended up being about wealthy people. I hadn't expected it to be, but it was Inconvenient People, and it's about all the poor people who got put away into luxury private lunatic asylums simply because their spouse or their family wanted to get their hands on their money.
And all of these crafted, of course, in a fine artisanal style in your garret.
Crafted in my little cupboard on the Tottenham Court Road, my rented home. I'm generation rent, although, alas, older than most of them. Yes, crafted in increasingly unremunerative self-employment. Please bring back social housing so Sarah can have a chance.
If you want to give £10 to Sarah... We're at the end of things. Sarah Wise, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Sarah Wise. Thanks too to John Allport and Bernie Barclay. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.